Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Regina, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop update on the treatment of ovarian cancer. And today's program is supported by GlaxoSmithKline. I really want to thank them for their support of this program today. Now, there are many of you on the call today. We have over 200 participants on the call, and you come from all of the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have a number of international participants from Algeria, Canada, Egypt, Ghana, and the United Kingdom. So this is a global call as well. So it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now, it's my pleasure to introduce our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. Carolyn Runowitz. Dr. Runowitz is Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Florida International University, Herbert Wertheim College of Medicine, recipient of ASCO Hologic Mentor Award. And Dr. Runowitz will be addressing an overview of ovarian cancer, including staging and current standard of care, managing treatment side effects, symptoms, neuropathy, discomfort, and pain, talking with your healthcare team about quality of life concerns, key questions to ask your healthcare team, and the increasing role of telehealth, telemedicine appointments. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Runowitz.
Thank you, and thank you for including me in this audio teleconference. I'm honored to join with these outstanding panel of experts that you've assembled. For most patients, the diagnosis of ovarian cancer is suspected by physical examination, symptoms, and radiologic testing. However, the definitive diagnosis is established at surgery, where biopsies or removal of the ovaries or fallopian tubes or peritoneal biopsies are performed. The pathologist, and we'll hear from Dr. Kerr later, makes the diagnosis. Epithelial ovarian cancer is the most common histologic diagnosis, but Dr. Kerr will discuss the pathology in more detail and the importance of the pathologist as part of the treatment team. For example, women diagnosed with clear cell, endometrioid, or mucinous ovarian cancer should be offered certain testing, for example, mismatch repair deficiency, as such patients may be appropriate candidates for immune checkpoint inhibition in the event of refractory or recurrent disease. And that's only one example. Dr. Kerr will enlighten us with other molecular testing. So at the time of surgery, complete surgical staging is important. It's important for treatment planning and prognostic counseling. We try to remove all of the visible tumor called cytoreduction or debulking surgery. In the case of disease spread beyond the ovary, the goal of surgery is to resect the tumor to minimal, ideally zero, gross residual disease. And what that means is that the surgeons cannot see any visible tumor left. The best surgical outcomes are when gynecologic oncologists who are specially trained in these surgical techniques perform this cytoreductive or debulking surgery. The goal of the surgery is to establish the stage and to remove all visible tumor. This usually includes a total hysterectomy with removal of both ovaries and fallopian tubes, called a bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy, an infracolic or even infragastric omentectomy. The omentum is a fat pad that is in the abdomen or the peritoneum and is a site for ovarian cancer metastases. So the surgeon will remove that, and so the pathologist can look at that omentum. pelvic and periaortic lymph node dissection may be needed to establish the stage of diagnosis, or if the nodes are very enlarged, they may be removed as part of the debulking or cytoreduction. Surgery can also include a bowel resection, and radical pelvic and upper abdominal surgery may be required. And that's why it's very important to have the surgery done by a gynecologic oncologist who is specifically trained in that radical surgery. In approximately a third of patients with advanced disease, the diagnosis may be based only on tissue or fluid obtained via image-guided biopsy or paracentesis or thoracentesis, that is tapping fluid that's in the belly or fluid that's in the lung, as the patient is deemed not to have disease that can be successfully cytoreduced, or the patient has comorbidities, that would be other serious medical illnesses, which preclude a cytoreductive surgical procedure. In that case, what we do is give neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And what that means is the chemotherapy is started before the surgery, as we've just described, the debulking surgery. And this neoadjuvant chemotherapy is usually based on an image-guided biopsy. In these cases, it is important to consult with a gynecologic oncologist regarding the possible timing of the deferred surgery. And perhaps as important, a gynecologic oncologist may feel that the patient actually is a good candidate for primary surgery and recommend that you proceed with primary surgery rather than the chemotherapy. And as I said, staging is determined at the time of surgery. Following surgery and after reviewing the pathology with the pathologist and a multidisciplinary tumor board, chemotherapy is initially usually with adjuvant platinum and taxane-based chemotherapy. However, as noted, some patients may receive what we call neoadjuvant chemotherapy or chemotherapy before surgery as an alternative option in selected patients. This neoadjuvant chemotherapy is usually reserved for patients with radiologic or clinical findings that suggest advanced disease that may not be amenable to cytoreductive surgery. So the chemotherapy is given to shrink the tumor so that a later deferred surgery can then be performed and remove the bulk of surgery. And again, it is very important that a gynecologic oncologist be consulted as to the decision for immediate surgery versus neoadjuvant chemotherapy and delayed surgery. So the standard approach for women receiving first-line chemotherapy for epithelial ovarian cancer is to use a platinum agent with a taxane. For women with optimally reduced disease, that is less than 1 centimeter of disease, there are two options: intravenous chemotherapy alone, or a combination of intravenous and directly into the belly, or intraperitoneal chemotherapy. For women receiving bevacizumab, which is an anti-angiogenesis agent, as upfront therapy or as maintenance therapy after chemotherapy, IV chemotherapy over IVIP may be recommended. For women with a serous or high-grade endometrioid ovarian cancer completing first-line chemotherapy with a complete or partial response, maintenance therapy should be considered based on several factors, including the BRCA mutation status, homologous recombination deficiency status, and other markers. Dr. Kerr will discuss this in more detail. Based on 4 randomized phase 3 studies, PARP inhibitors should be considered following chemotherapy in accordance with guidelines from the American Society of Clinical Oncology and the Society of Gynecologic Oncology. These recommendations are based on the observation that use of a PARP inhibitor as maintenance therapy has demonstrated progression-free survival advantage even for patients without a BRCA or BRCA1/2 mutation in some but not all trials. While the largest benefit in the absence of a BRCA mutation has been seen in women who have had evidence of homologous recombinant deficiency, women without HRD may also derive some benefit, although it is modest. Again, pointing out to the importance of the pathologist as a member of the multidisciplinary team. All patients with a diagnosis of ovarian, fallopian tube, or peritoneal carcinoma should have a genetic risk evaluation unrelated to their family history. Obviously, if the family history is very significant, that would point one to get a genetic risk evaluation. But even in those families without such a history, it is very important that one rules out genetic or familial cancer syndromes such as BRCA or Lynch, or a genetic mutation that can impact treatment or post-treatment care. Telehealth came into play for all of us in practice with COVID. We were unable to see our patients face-to-face in person, so telehealth became very important for us for continuity and care of our patients. It's also sometimes referred to as telemedicine. This is when the doctors or other healthcare providers provide services using electronic means. Telehealth visits are typically done by phone or video and can also include email and text messages between a patient and their providers. However, there have been obstacles to widespread implementation, which largely center around licensure requirements. There may be hope on the horizon. The Telehealth Extension Act, for example, aims to lift geographic restrictions to allow people with Medicare to access healthcare no matter where they live. Beyond telehealth visits by phone or video, another component of telehealth where interest is surging is remote monitoring of patient symptoms via their smartphones and other devices. Telehealth's role in cancer care will continue to evolve, but experts agree that it will probably be a hybrid approach of telehealth and in-person care. Now I would like to just talk to you about managing side effects. Although we haven't talked a lot about the side effects of the chemotherapy at this point, and we haven't talked about treatment options for recurrent ovarian cancer, Dr. Brewer is going to cover that, but we thought that I would first start with managing side effects. So nausea and vomiting is common with chemotherapy, and it can be pretty severe. So there have been many drugs that have been developed over the decades since I was in practice. When I first started, which was a long time ago, there was minimal. The steroids were about all that we had. However, there are now multiple categories of drugs with very high therapeutic indices, meaning they're very effective for the management of chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. There are three 5-HT3 receptor agonists, the neurokinin 1 receptor antagonist, NK1R, glucocorticoids, especially dexamethasone, and the medication olanzapine, which is traditionally used for psychiatric conditions, but is very useful when used in combination with other antiemetics. So what's important from this conversation is that you need to speak to your healthcare team to find out exactly what you're getting and are there other drugs that can be added so that you can eliminate the nausea and vomiting. Chemotherapy is often divided into highly emetogenic agents such as cisplatin or patients that have moderate emetogenic regimens. And based on how emetogenic or nausea-inducing the treatments are, the treatment team will develop or design a prescription to manage your side effects. So again, it's very, very, very important that you speak to your healthcare team and get treatment, not only for the day of treatment, but also for delayed nausea and vomiting when you get home. Another side effect that we have is neuropathy. And neuropathy is peripheral nerve damage from the chemotherapy. And in our disease of ovarian cancer, taxanes are often the responsible agents for this neuropathy. And peripheral neuropathy can be very disabling. One can't button a blouse. The hearing can get impacted. So it's a really important side effect to discuss with your treatment team. So the treatments that have been available with taxanes or platinum drugs, duloxetine has been very effective, and again, is a drug you should discuss with your treatment team. The gabapentin is also, or may also be used, although the data is not as strong. And lastly, one of the fears of patients is pain. And the pain can be managed from surgery, and especially if you're having minimally invasive surgery, which would be, say, for example, robotic surgery, then your pain is much less than if you have an incision that runs from the rib cage down to the pubic bone. And in a debulking with large tumor masses in the pelvis and in the upper abdomen, such incisions can be needed to adequately debulk or try to reduce the cancer. And again, it's the treatments for pain have evolved over the last several decades, and I urge you to speak with your healthcare providers to get appropriate treatment and appropriate pain medications while you're in the recovery period, or if you develop pain as a result of recurrent disease. So I think with that, I will stop and turn the program back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Runowitz. That was a superb presentation. Very, very well done, I have to say, just stellar, and covering many, many topics. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. Thank you. And you really set the tone for today's program, so thank you again. And our next speaker is Dr. Molly Brewer, and Dr. Brewer is Professor and Chair, Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Division of Gynecologic Oncology, Carol and Ray Nieg Comprehensive Cancer Center, University of Connecticut Health Center. And Dr. Brewer will be addressing new treatment approaches and follow-up care, treatment options for recurrent ovarian cancer, and clinical trial updates, how clinical trials offer additional treatment options. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Brewer.
Great. Thank you so much, Carolyn. So Carolyn Runowitz, my friend and colleague, has touched on a lot of the treatments. She really went over kind of what we call our upfront treatment, which is the initial treatment for ovarian cancer. And when we're talking about ovarian cancer, we're usually talking about high-grade ovarian cancer, which is the most common one that we see. And she discussed the PARP inhibitors. So in the last probably 5 or 6 years, we now have 3 PARP inhibitors that have actually been approved by the FDA for treatment for either as adjuvant treatment following chemotherapy. They're studying whether it helps during chemotherapy or whether it can be used in the recurrent setting. And there's a lot of data coming out that, and we're still not completely clear how to use these drugs, but what these drugs essentially do is the PART pathway is what we call a DNA repair pathway, and it allows the tumor cells to actually repair themselves and become active again. And if we block that pathway, for many patients, that will prevent that. So this is appropriate for patients that carry a BRCA mutation. I think our genetic counselor will touch more on that, or what we call a homologous recombination deficiency. So we also call that HRD. And depending on what mutation patients have, these work to a greater or lesser degree. One of the things that we've recently learned about PARP inhibitors is probably 3 years is about as long as these can safely be given, because there are some side effects to continuing to give them beyond that time. Again, data is coming out every day about how to best use these drugs. Another drug that has been looked at fairly significantly is a drug called Avastin. And this is a drug that actually, we call it an angiogenesis inhibitor. And what that means is it prevents new blood cells, new blood cells and blood formation in tumors. And if tumors don't have a blood supply, they can't grow. And these drugs have been investigated in what we call the upfront setting. In other words, initially after surgery. And although it seemed to affect and prevent the recurrence a little bit longer, when they looked at things at the end of the day, it did not really help patients in terms of their cancer. So we've actually moved from using it for the most part in the upfront setting to use it in the recurrent setting. So there's a lot of data now showing that in the recurrent setting, in other words, when these cancers come back, that Avastin has a lot of activity. So when we do talk about cancer coming back, we kind of put patients in two categories. We consider them either to be platinum sensitive or platinum resistant. And that's really going to determine the next treatment options. So platinum sensitive are patients that go more than 6 to 12 months following their initial treatment before their cancer recurs. Platinum resistant recur within that 6 months following chemotherapy. And the treatments are very different. One of the things that has now come out is there's a number of monoclonal antibodies that actually are quite valuable in treating these cancers. Avastin is one of the monoclonal antibodies. This is an antibody actually against one of the pathways that develops new blood cells. Another really important one is in what we call the checkpoint inhibitors. And these actually enable the tumor-fighting T cells to kill cancer cells. They block proteins known as checkpoints that become programmed by the cancer cells to keep these T cells from attacking. So pembrolizumab is one of the ones that has now come out as being extremely important in ovarian cancer. Some of the initial studies showed that it only worked in about 10% of the patients, but as we're learning more about pembrolizumab, also known as Keytruda, we found that actually it has more and more of an application. So, and this comes to the next thing that I think is extremely important. Carolyn talked about how important it is to work with your gynecologic oncologist. Ovarian cancer has a predisposition to coming back. And what we want to do is we want to treat this cancer as best we can. And so one of the things that we now do on almost all of our patients is we send tumor out for additional testing. And what they look at is they look at genomic pathways, and it helps us know what will best attack that tumor. So patients that have what we call a microsatellite instability, this will be found on the tumor testing. A DNA mismatch repair deficiency, again, this will be found on the tumor testing, or a high tumor mutational burden. All of these are patients that will potentially benefit from this pembrolizumab or Keytruda. Another checkpoint inhibitor and it again, it attacks the same pathway. It's called the PD-1 or PD-L1 pathway. These are growth pathways in cancers. It's called dostarlimab, also known as Jemperli. This is another checkpoint inhibitor, and this targets this same pathway as Keytruda. The major indication for this is if you have a patient that has this DNA mismatch repair. So these are things that we actually find on our additional testing. Another thing that has come out in the last year, which is very exciting, is attacking or targeting the folate receptor alpha. So this is actually a receptor that's present on a large majority of ovarian cancer cells. In some publications, it looks like it's up to about 90%. And this has actually been combined with this drug that will actually cause intracellular release of DM4. And this is a cytotoxic tubulin inhibitor. So the tubules are important in cells that divide. And so it prevents cell division. So this is actually found, has found that if they have strong presence of this folate receptor alpha, that this is a drug that works extremely well. And this is a combination drug, so it has one drug that targets that receptor and one drug that actually gets inside the cell and helps prevent the cell from dividing. And this is a drug called Elahere, E-L-A-H-E-R-E, and it's relatively new. It came out at the beginning of 2023. And so, again, this will be something that will be found when you do the tumor testing, because we always ask now for this folate receptor alpha since we know now that we have something that we can block it. So another treatment that is gaining interest, the data is somewhat controversial, but it's called HIPEC, and this is hyperthermic intraperitoneal chemotherapy. And basically this is, for the most part, in the recurrent setting, although some people are looking at it in the upfront setting that Carolyn talked about. But this is actually where you go in surgically, you take out as much of the tumor as you can. You want to get it all out if you can. And then you infuse, before you close, you infuse the abdominal cavity with this heated chemotherapy. And it's heated up to about 41 degrees. That's 41 degrees centigrade. So our body is about 36.5 to 37 degrees centigrade. So it's about three or four degrees above centigrade above our normal body temperature. And this is felt to increase the chemotherapy getting into the cancer cells. Again, this is a little bit controversial. There are some people that are trying it both in the upfront and the recurrent setting, and data has is coming out now that there may be some patients that this is effective. Another really interesting treatment category, and you've probably heard about it in the lymphomas, and because that's where it's really been the most applicable, is what's called CAR T cell therapy. This is a therapy where the T cells, these are some of the immune cells, they're removed from the patient's blood. They're changed in the lab by adding a gene for a receptor. It's called a chimeric antigen receptor. That's what the CAR or CAR stands for. And this actually helps T cells attach to a specific cancer cell. The CAR T cells are then given back to the patient. So you really target the particular tumor. Since different cancers have different antigens, now antigens are what are expressed on the surface. This CAR is made for a specific cancer's antigen. In certain kinds of leukemia or lymphoma, the cancer cells have an antigen called CD19. So in these particular cases, they'll target that antigen. In ovarian cancer, they are starting to look at targeting some of these antigens. Again, this is a very specialized treatment. It carries a very high morbidity in some patients, but we're starting to see some reports that this has some potential for, you know, these resistant cancers in particular. There's new combinations now that are being looked at. there's an old treatment, which was low-dose cyclophosphamide or Cytoxan. It's a really old treatment for ovary cancer. And this is actually given orally at a very low dose in combination with Avastin. And Avastin is the one that I talked about previously that actually targets the pathways that develop these blood cells and these vascular channels. And now we are finding that if we add pembrolizumab or Keytruda to that combination, that we're really getting, in the recurrent setting in particular, we're getting some very nice responses with very low morbidity. One of the things that we don't talk about very much is low-grade ovarian cancer. This is about 10 to 15% of these cancers, particularly in younger women, and they haven't responded particularly well to traditional chemotherapy. There's a lot of work done because they tend to express the estrogen receptor, but there's some new combinations, and I'm gonna slaughter the pronunciation, but it's avutometinib. It's a RAF and MEK inhibitor. So these are pathways that promote cancer growth in combination with defactinib, and these have actually shown a very nice response in these low-grade cancers. There's lots of other things that are coming down the path, and one of the reasons that it's so important to be connected to a GYN oncologist is to have access to clinical trials. And clinical trials are extremely important because what they do for patients is they potentially give you something that you won't be able to get otherwise. And a phase one clinical trial is really looking at toxicity, but one of the things that they evaluate is also, does it work? We call it efficacy. A phase two trial comes usually from a phase one trial where they found a drug that actually appears to have an impact in, for example, ovary cancer. And what we do with that is we then test it. We found the right dose that doesn't create too much toxicity, and we test it in ovary cancer patients. Usually it's in when these cancers have come back, what we call the recurrent setting. And, you know, these are important because they may be, you know, given next to the standard of care. That's oftentimes how these phase two trials are, or they may just be given by themselves. Then the next clinical trial is a phase three trial. And these are trials that actually we know that they work against ovary cancer, but now we want to see how well do they work to all comers, at least, you know, if they meet the criteria. So I really want to encourage people to seek out clinical trials. As I tell my patients, I don't encourage clinical trials in what we call the upfront setting because we have drugs that we know work and work pretty well. But once these cancers come back, now if it comes back and you're what we consider platinum resistant, that's the time to actually start to look for what trials might be available. If you're platinum sensitive and you've gone a long time before your cancer has come back, then you're potentially a candidate for a reoperation, depending on how much cancer there is, versus a platinum-based treatment. But at any point in here, once these cancers have come back, would be the time that I would recommend at least looking to see what's available in your area. You know, if you live far from where the clinical trials are, it may not be possible. But, you know, I do, you know, for example, I live in Connecticut and I send a lot, we have some clinical trials. I send a lot of people to Dana-Farber because they're really good colleagues and they have a lot of really nice clinical trials for my patients. So that pretty much winds up what I wanted to talk about in terms of treatment options, new treatment options. What I want to leave you with is there's lots of things that are coming. For years, we had platinum and we had Taxol, and that's all we had. And now we have so many more options for patients that, you know, it's very exciting. As a GYN oncologist, I see that, you know, we can keep our patients happy and healthy much longer than we could even 10 years ago. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bro, that was a wonderful presentation and just an excellent review of all of the information that our participants need to hear. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. And our next speaker will be Sarah Kerr. Sarah Kerr is a pathologist, Hospital Pathology Associates, Division of Cytopathology, Pulmonary Gynecologic and Molecular Pathology, Alina Health Laboratories, Alina Healthcare Cancer Institute. And Dr. Kerr will be addressing the role of the pathologist, how precision medicine, biomarker, and genetic testing inform your treatment decisions, guidelines for preparing for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, follow-up care, and discussion of open notes. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Kerr.
Well, thank you. Hello, everyone. It is my great pleasure to explain pathology reports, precision medicine, and biomarkers, which was touched on a little bit by the prior speakers, and also some related topics about online medical records. So I'm a pathologist who creates pathology reports every day as part of my job. And a pathologist is a medical doctor who graduates from medical school with the rest of your doctors and then goes on to specialize in diagnostics and laboratory testing. So every time you get blood drawn or a biopsy or a surgery, that blood or tissue or fluid goes to pathology, also known as the hospital laboratory or the clinical laboratory. A pathology diagnosis of metastatic ovarian cancer can be made initially in some patients by taking out some of the fluid around the organs in the belly or around the lung, or by taking a small sample of tumor with a needle through the skin. But if the tumor appears to be contained to the ovary on the initial imaging, surgery might actually be the upfront first step to a pathology diagnosis to try to get a large ovarian tumor out intact so that the tumor doesn't rupture or spill into the abdomen, which it might do if a biopsy was attempted in those early stage cancers. So after that biopsy or the surgery, the specimen is processed onto glass slides for a pathologist to look at under a microscope. So high-grade serous carcinoma is one of the cancers that we've heard about on this teleconference, and it's the most common type of advanced tubal ovarian cancer. But there are other types of ovarian cancers, such as low-grade serous carcinoma that Dr. Brewer touched on, borderline tumors, endometrioid carcinoma, clear cell carcinoma, mucinous carcinoma, and even sex cord stromal tumors like granulosa cell tumor can be advanced or recur. And these different kinds of cancer can have very different approaches to treatment, so it's really important to get this step of diagnosis right. There are cases where high-stage ovarian cancer is almost certain clinically based on imaging and tumor markers in the blood, but a biopsy examination under a microscope proves an entirely different type of cancer or even benign findings that radically change the treatment plan. So waiting for this pathology report is extremely important. For example, yesterday I helped a surgeon who was doing surgery for what they thought was ovarian cancer, and it turned out to actually be a tumor that was coming from the appendix, which would have a very different treatment. And that's a very common scenario that you have cancers that spread to the ovary from other sites that mimic ovarian cancer. So it's really important for a pathologist to look at all those tissues and make the right diagnosis. It usually takes a few days to prepare a final pathology report after the tissue is sent to the laboratory, but it may take longer for ovarian cancers that are rare or have unusual characteristics, where multiple additional tests or opinions from other pathologists are needed to obtain the most correct diagnosis. The pathology report itself is often written in complex medical language. So, be sure to ask questions and go over the report with your cancer team to help you understand the diagnosis and staging. And because pathology language is sort of written in a particular way, I even, have oncologists call me about tumor types, asking me, what is this tumor type? I've never treated this before, and pathologists are really the expert in that area. So Okay, so in ovarian cancer, individualized treatment plans for patients are based on biomarker tests, which have been touched on by the previous speakers. And these biomarker tests are becoming an increasing part of care. This is sometimes called precision medicine because the treatment plan can be tailored more precisely based on the test results from the tumor. A biomarker can be anything from a stain that the pathologist looks at under a microscope to genetic testing of the BRCA genes, either in the blood or next-generation sequencing using tumor tissue. So in addition to making a tumor diagnosis, the pathologist may apply special stains to the tumor to figure out which markers are active in the tumor that could respond to these individualized treatments. So tests like estrogen receptor in low-grade tumors or mismatch repair enzymes for endometrioid type or clear cell carcinoma, or a relatively new marker that was touched on by Dr. Brewer in platinum-resistant ovarian cancer that's usually high-grade serous carcinoma is called the folate receptor alpha, or FOLR1. These stains are being interpreted by a pathologist under a microscope to give your oncologist additional information to help individualize those therapy recommendations. So FOLR1, as was mentioned previously, or folate receptor alpha, is one of these new biomarkers for a new type of drug called an antibody drug conjugate. And as was touched on, this treatment basically tricks the cancer cells into taking in a drug by stimulating something it's looking at to grow. So this folate receptor is bound by the antibody, which gets the drug in that stops the microtubule formation or the growth of the cancer. So other types of biomarkers other than stains generally require testing of the genetics of the tumor tissue to look for changes in the DNA. So these technologies are often referred to as next-generation sequencing. Next-generation sequencing in ovarian cancer can evaluate for markers like the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes or characteristics of the DNA and chromosomes, collectively called homologous recombination repair deficiency, or HRD for short. You may have gone to see a genetic counselor, and we'll hear from a genetic counselor next. To test you for hereditary breast and ovarian cancer, which most commonly results from a mutation in one of the BRCA genes. Well, in some patients, the mutation is not found in the blood to be passed along to the family, but their tumor still has a BRCA mutation or this HRD, homologous recombination repair deficiency, which is found only in the tumor tissue and can still be used as a biomarker to determine if those therapies called PARP inhibitors are more or less likely to be successful for your treatment. So for precision medicine and ovarian cancer, a combination of tests, including tissue stains and next-generation sequencing, are increasingly being used to help choose those best treatments to try next if you have advanced ovarian cancer. Okay, so moving on from pathology and precision medicine, Dr. Mesner also asked me to say a word about recent changes in online access to your medical records. So in the last few years, many care teams communicate with patients through online applications or portals that work on your smartphone or computer, and some appointments can even be done online, as was described, rather than in person. You are also able to access your pathology reports, CT scans, and the visit notes from your doctors online in many cases. And one of the major differences that you may see now is that pathology reports or radiology scans that were previously held a few days to give a chance for your doctor to review first before releasing to you online, now regulations have changed so that your results are released immediately for you to see if you choose to have access. So having those results immediately available can be really empowering to some people, but also could potentially be overwhelming to others. So this is something to talk about with your doctor ahead of time in terms of how you want to handle receiving those results and how you'll be supported if you get those results, knowing that you may see the results first even before your doctor knows about them. Okay, so that's all I have for today. Thanks so much for listening to me talk about pathology and precision medicine. I'm now turning the conference back over to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Kerr. That was just a wonderful presentation, very informative, just stellar, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. Thank you so much. Such an important topic. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Kara Rogan, and Ms. Rogan is a licensed certified genetic counselor, Department of Clinical Genomics, Clinical Instructor of Medicine, of Medical Genetics, Mayo Clinic. And Ms. Rogan will be addressing understanding the role of the genetic counselor and the importance of genetic testing.
Introduction, and thank you for having me today. So the role of a genetic counselor is to help facilitate and guide patients diagnosed with ovarian cancer through the process of germline genetic testing. And when I say germline genetic testing, that refers to testing that's performed on a blood or saliva sample that looks for disruptions or changes that we usually call mutations to the genes that you were born with. So this is a little different than the genetic testing an oncologist may order on the tumor itself. And we know that around 20% of women diagnosed with ovarian cancer are found to have an underlying genetic cause for their ovarian cancer. And that likelihood may be even a little higher for women with a personal or family history of breast, ovarian, prostate, pancreatic, colon, or uterine cancer. And when women have a hereditary ovarian cancer gene mutation, their lifetime risk of developing ovarian cancer is higher than the average woman's risk of about 1 to 2%. So the first genes identified that are linked to hereditary ovarian cancer were the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, or BRCA genes that our other panelists have referred to. Prior to 2013, these were really the only genes that were available for clinical genetic testing. We now test for many more genes linked to hereditary risk for ovarian cancer, including BRIP1, RAD51C, RAD51D, the Lynch syndrome genes, just to name a few. So some women who previously had negative genetic testing for BRCA1 and BRCA2 only may be eligible for updated multi-gene panel testing. Somewhat more recent addition since 2018 is the option of doing paired DNA and RNA analysis on a blood sample, and adding in that paired RNA analysis does increase the likelihood of a positive test result in around 1 in 200 individuals who are tested. At the genetic counseling appointment, the genetic counselor reviews what will be included on the testing, what the possible results could mean, and what they would mean for the patient and their family members. They also discuss, you know, insurance coverage of testing, review some of the laws that we have that surround genetic discrimination, and then once the results of the testing are available, the genetic counselor reviews and interprets those results for the patient and their care team. So one benefit of genetic testing, which has been discussed by our panelists, is for determining the treatment of ovarian cancer, so I won't touch on that further. Another benefit of genetic testing is identifying other cancer risks in the patient and their relatives. So if a gene mutation is identified that, you know, is linked to ovarian cancer, generally, there's other cancer types that are also linked to that same gene mutation, and so then we discuss options for high-risk screening and preventive measures that can be implemented. Also, when a gene mutation is identified in someone with ovarian cancer, we then recommend genetic testing for their relatives. So their first-degree relatives, like parents, siblings and children have a 50% chance of having that same gene mutation. And for other relatives who test positive for that mutation, they can take some of those same screening and preventive measures as well. At this time, we don't have very effective screening for ovarian cancer. So when an individual is found to have a hereditary risk for ovarian cancer, it's generally recommended to undergo a risk-reducing salpingo-oophorectomy, which is removal of the ovaries and fallopian tubes. I think one area of promise for the future is a newer test called multi-cancer early detection, which screens for several types of cancer, including ovarian cancer, just on a blood test. There is one FDA-approved product right now called the Galleri test, which is typically available at an out-of-pocket cost. And Mayo Clinic conducted the Pathfinder study that kind of led to the development of that product, and they're now working on the Pathfinder 2 study to really just study the screening test a little bit further. This multi-cancer early detection screening really hasn't been studied in high-risk populations, such as individuals with hereditary gene mutations, and doesn't replace standard screening and prevention recommendations. But again, I think it's one area of possibility for the future. So just to kind of wrap it up, I would say that genetics is a really quickly changing field. We're making new discoveries every day about the hereditary causes of cancer and how to improve our genetic tests. We also can continue to gain insight into the exact cancer risks associated with each gene, as there is some uncertainty at this time. And genetic counselors really remain at the forefront of these changes to help educate patients, their families, and providers about advances in the field. We're also available to help families cope with a diagnosis of hereditary cancer and empower them to be proactive regarding their cancer risks. We also partner closely with the rest of the care team to communicate results and current medical management guidelines, and also help connect patients and their families with available resources and research studies. So with that, I'm going to hand the program back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much. Ms. Rogan, that was an outstanding presentation, a lot of wonderful information for participants. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Allison Moskowitz-Duggan, and Ms. Duggan will be addressing, she's an oncology social worker, and she is our internship program manager at Cancer Care, and she'll be discussing Cancer Care's free programs and services, our Hope Line, and website. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Duggan.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much, Dr. Messner. I'm happy to be part of this call. Before I get started, I just want to provide a brief overview of Cancer Care. We are a national leading nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling, and support groups, educational workshops such as these, community programs, publications, and potential financial assistance. To become connected to any cancer care services, those interested can call Cancer Care's National Helpline to speak to an oncology social worker. As we all know, a cancer diagnosis can be very overwhelming, and additional support and guidance may help relieve any feelings of anxiety that are coming up. Working with one-on-one with an oncology social worker through individual counseling can offer a space to express one's feelings, emotions, and concerns. And please note that Cancer Care does offer free cancer-focused counseling to individuals who are impacted by cancer for those who live in New York and New Jersey. Joining a support group can also be another way of getting additional support through this time. Being a member of a support group can offer the opportunity to speak to others, gather and provide support, as well as obtain information that can be useful. Cancer Care offers online support groups to individuals across the country, which take place using a password-protected format, message board format that are led by oncology social workers who can offer support and guidance. Groups are held for 15 weeks at a time, and you can register on our website to join. We do currently offer a group specifically for women with ovarian cancer. People diagnosed with cancer may experience practical and financial concerns through one's treatment. It may be helpful to connect to discuss any potential financial concerns with your medical providers or social worker, patient navigator, as well as the financial department at the treatment center to see if there's any financial options available to you. Cancer Care does offer some limited financial assistance to individuals who qualify with ovarian cancer as well. Cancer Care also offers free telephone support, resource navigation services to people with living in cancer, post-treatment survivors, and caregivers. These services are provided in English and Spanish, and the service focuses on practical challenges that arise from cancer by providing resources, referrals, and potential financial assistance options. Dr. Brewer spoke about how clinical trials can offer additional treatment options for individuals with ovarian cancer. Cancer Care does now offer an online tool called My Trial List that provides information on clinical trials, answers commonly asked questions about clinical trials, and helps patients and caregivers find possible clinical trials that meet their needs. And please note, finally, that you can always go on Cancer Care's website, cancercare.org, to access a wide variety of reading materials, information about ovarian cancer, including recorded Connect education workshops, Cancer Care Out Loud, the Cancer Care podcast, and multiple publications about this topic. If you are interested in learning more, please explore the website and, of course, again, call our helpline at 800-813-4673 to speak to one of our oncology social workers. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to speak on this informative program. I will now turn the program back to Dr. Messner.
Thank you so much, Ms. Duggan. That was a wonderful presentation, wonderful resource for people. And now we're going to move right on to the Q&A. And I'm going to ask Regina to explain to you how to queue up for questions. I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Regina?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we'll take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
And a question for Dr. Brewer. I'm going to spell this E-L-A-H-E-R, might be in my future, as I am a candidate, but very concerned about the eye side effects of blurriness and its impact on my daily life as I am 76 and live alone. Besides driving issues, how can I function if I cannot simply read anything from prescription directions to food prep instructions, the joy of a book? Could you comment on this, Dr. Brewer?
Yeah, so that's a great question because that is probably the most common side effect from this drug. One of the things that they recommend is partnering with an ophthalmologist, so you need to be followed closely by an ophthalmologist. They also recommend using lubricants in your eyes because this apparently tends to decrease the side effects. But I think, you know, the key thing is working with both your GYN oncologist and an ophthalmologist.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Another question for Dr. Runowitz. After treatment, surgery, chemo, when is it determined that someone is in remission? Why is the patient not still monitored?
So remission is usually defined either by a second look surgery, which is rarely performed anymore but was more common and may be built into clinical trials, or after six cycles of therapy, initial therapy, if the CA125 has returned to normal, the person is determined to be in remission and will be offered some kind of consolidation therapy or maintenance therapy to maintain that remission.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Brewer. Is anyone tracking use of sound wave technology or histotripsy to destroy tumors? A clinical trial is active for liver cancer or mets to the liver.
Yeah, that's another really good question because I think that, you know, there have been multiple attempts to try to figure out what can be used in the abdominal cavity to destroy these cancers. So far, nothing has really panned out. You know, in terms of liver tumors, one of the things that one can do if you have a really good interventional radiologist who's interested in giving intra-arterial chemotherapy, you know, that may be an option if it's limited to the liver. But, you know, we haven't been as successful as we thought we could be in developing technologies to destroy these cancers.
Excellent, thank you. And for Ms. Rogan, if a family member has ovarian cancer, can genetic screening determine if other family members will get the disease?
Yeah, you know, we generally recommend starting genetic testing with someone who actually has been diagnosed with cancer first. Again, only about 20% of women with ovarian cancer will have a underlying genetic cause. And so if the person with ovarian cancer's testing is negative, then we generally don't have any genetic testing to recommend for family members. If the person with ovarian cancer is not available for testing or isn't interested in testing, then we can test unaffected family members or family members without cancer first, but our preference is to test the person with ovarian cancer first.
And this is the last question for Dr. Kerr. I had stage 3 ovarian cancer and finished treatment about 6 months ago. I'm so scared about recurrence. Would I just have an elevated CA, or are there other things that would be picked up by a pathologist?
Yeah, so tumor markers are a really great tool that your oncologist will use, and those tests go through a clinical laboratory, and CA125 is one of those markers. Some cancers secrete other tumor markers like CEA that could be followed, or inhibin. But if CA125 is your tumor marker that they're following, that's a good, it's a good indicator, but not perfect. And so your oncologist and others could jump in if they want to, but your oncologist could use, you know, imaging for observation, as well as, you know, some other emerging technologies. But those, that tumor marker that you mentioned, the CA125, is one of those that we run in the laboratory to monitor patients over time.
So thank you. And we're going to now do takeaways from each of the speakers. I'm going to ask you each to just give a minute or less than a minute takeaway of what you'd like people to take away from the program. I'll start with Dr. Runowitz.
Yes, I think it's a team sport, that the surgeon, the G1 oncologist, is perhaps the captain of the ship, but you need all of these other people who we've heard from today as part of the team. And during the tumor board where the tumors are discussed, there's definitely the importance of a team at that time, too.
Thank you. And Dr. Brewer?
So I think what I would want to emphasize is a couple of things. One is it's very important if your cancer does come back to look at the genomic testing that we talked about, because that will open a lot of doors potentially. I think the second kind of takeaway is have a low threshold for looking into clinical trials, because that gives you opportunities that you would not have otherwise.
Excellent, thank you. And Dr. Kerr?
Yeah, so from a pathologist standpoint, the thing that I want patients to be aware of is keeping track of your pathology reports. So some patients are lucky enough to go through treatment and go into remission and have a pretty long interval before their recurrence. And they might be living in a different place with a different doctor when their cancer comes back. And it's so helpful to the pathologist to know what type of cancer they had before. And having that pathology report available is just really, really helpful and saves a lot of money and time in being able to make a diagnosis of either recurrent cancer or a different type of cancer.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Ms. Rogan?
Yeah, you know, I would just encourage everyone diagnosed with ovarian cancer to consider genetic testing, or if you've had genetic testing and it's been a few years, to visit with a genetic counselor to see if there's any new testing options available. Again, it can be very important for determining the best treatment plan for the ovarian cancer, but also can be beneficial for your relatives as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Ms. Duggan?
Yes, I'd just like to do a brief reminder that although this can be extremely challenging to cope with ovarian cancer, know that there are several resources out there to be able to assist, tapping into those resources that are available through your healthcare team, as well as any external resources such as cancer care services or seeking counseling support groups. financial assistance at many other organizations that do provide that.
Thank you. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been phenomenal. I want to thank our participants also for asking such great questions that really allowed us to provide more information to all of you, so I want to thank you all. However, I do want to acknowledge that we were not able to take all of your questions, so I want to say something about that. For those of you who had an opportunity to ask a question, for those of you who have a question that was in queue or are thinking of another question, I'd like all of you to go back to your treating healthcare team and ask your healthcare team the question that you asked, either during the program or would like to ask. Because your healthcare team knows you the best, they have your medical records, they are incredibly familiar with you, so please be aware that the healthcare team is the person you should go back to, because you hopefully have learned things during today's program, and that because of what you've learned, you'll be able to take that back to treating healthcare team. Also, as we conclude the program today, I would not want anyone to feel alone in coping with ovarian cancer, any type of cancer. I want you to now know that you're part of the community support, and we're here to help you, both your healthcare team, as well as Cancer Care and many other organizations. And we will be sending you a SurveyMonkey evaluation in a couple of days. And in that evaluation, there will be an evaluation of the program, which we always like you're filling out, but we'll also provide any resource that we mentioned or didn't mention that we think would be useful to you. So I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.